We're going to first do a call to order. The time now is 8:31 on January 25th, 2023. I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, can you please call the roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Medina?
Present.
Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Okay, we have quorum and may proceed.
Great, thank you. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 32-2081H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website, pursuant to ARS 32-2081H1. And upon the vote, upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the committee may enter into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431.03A2 to review confidential records or subsection, or for subsection A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Ms. Galvin. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based on the parties present. Please, and this is very important, Please only use initials when referring to patients, children, or the complainant. So don't use their names, but just their initials. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or a representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee to up to 5 minutes, but only when prompted by the chair. Additionally, the licensee or respondent who is the subject of the complaint will also have an opportunity to make a brief 5-minute statement, again, only when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or the respondent after their statement is made. Please note that only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and the respondent, may address the committee and make statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make the request during the case review. For anyone in attendance today, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, or legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note that individuals in attendance who speak without committee approval will be warned twice by the committee, by the chair, not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter. We are now going to go to item number 3A on our agenda. The first complaint scheduled for today's review is case number 2309 for Dr. Sue Moeller. Dr. Stewart, you are the lead. Would you like to provide a brief summary? And you are on mute, Dr. Stewart, if you'd like to.
Thank you. Case number 2309, Sue Moeller, PsyD, received her doctorate degree from the Lyon International University in 2006. She's been licensed since April of 2021 in the state of Arizona. Excuse me. She was issued a psychology degree in licensed in 2021, working for an agency of both behavioral health and virtual, in-person and virtual services. And we have a complainant whose teenage daughter began therapy with Dr. Moeller in 2021 when she was 15 years of age. The father and daughter's mother maintained joint legal custody of the daughter, who splits her time between both households. The daughter's session with Dr. Moeller focused in part on processing information and experiences of the daughter. And some of this is confidential health information, and I'll skip over that part. Ms. Galvin, I don't know if I need to go into executive session to ask about an emancipation.
No, that is not a matter of confidential statutes. You may, yes. Okay.
Thank you. In March of 22, the daughter submitted a petition for emancipation with Maricopa Superior Court. At the time, she was 16. The father objected to the emancipation, but mother did not. On July 18th, 2022, Dr. Muller issued a letter, not addressed to anyone, so it's to me, to whom it may concern letter, indicating that she is in support of daughter's emancipation. And there's a, in your packet, there's a screenshot of the letter written supposedly by Dr. Muller. Dr. Muller was contacted by the guardian ad litem that had been appointed by the court for the daughter in during the process of the emancipation petition. And about a month after the letter was issued, in August of 2022, another hearing took place regarding the daughter's emancipation petition, and Dr. Muller testified in that hearing, as she had received a subpoena from the guardian ad litem. And as I'm recalling, she even had the court issue an order for her to testify, as I recall. Dr. Muller terminated with the daughter in treatment. The father filed a complaint in September of 2022 regarding Dr. Muller. And the father alleges that there was irreparable harm done to the daughter by failing to meet some of her needs, that Dr. Muller failed to include the parents in the counseling, that she chose to involve herself in the court case by writing a letter to the court. And to this allegation, and is apparently working with the GAL. Guardian ad litem. In the letter, she made recommendation regarding the daughter's emancipation, despite acknowledging during her testimony that she had no prior knowledge or experience with emancipation matters. Her letter was only provided to the GAL, not the parents. The parents only received the letter after the hearing. She inappropriately terminated the daughter's treatment, and father alleges that this caused a deterioration in the relationship between the father and the daughter. I'm trying to look at Dr. Muller's response. Dr. Muller indicates that the treatment she provided to the daughter was beneficial. Her conduct was consistent with applicable professional and ethical standards at all times. The father's complaint was intended as retaliation by the parent, who was unhappy that Dr. Muller's professional opinions did not align with his own litigation objectives. Throughout Dr. Muller's treatment with daughter, father exhibited therapeutic interfering behaviors that included threatening Dr. Muller with legal and professional consequences for expressing opinions that he perceived to be inconsistent with his own personal objectives in the ongoing custody fight. It was father's interfering behaviors that caused the damage to the relationship between Dr. Muller and daughter, which ultimately persuaded Dr. Muller it was in the best interest of her client, the daughter, to terminate the relationship and refer the daughter to another behavioral health provider. The complaint screening committee should dismiss the complaint as it's lacking any meritorious claims. I think that's about the response.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Appreciate that. Is the complainant JD present?
I am.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today, JD. I'd like to give you, if you'd like to make a brief statement to the board, and then the board members may have some questions for you.
Okay. Rather than read a statement, I'll just address a couple of the comments that Mr. Stewart made in his summary. Dr. Mueller did voluntarily talk to the GAL and shared medical information with her. I never gave any consent, nor was I aware of it. She wrote a letter to the court that was submitted through the GAL. She chose to testify. She made assessments about my family home, my relationship with my wife, and our dynamic and the choices we made without any information about why we may have done them. She never once reached out to ask why. While she can claim that I challenged her opinions, I did not challenge anything she said ever about therapy. In fact, I frequently asked her, how can I help my daughter? I asked her for help in fixing my daughter's misperceptions about events that happened. She never once gave me any recommendations on how to help with these things, only telling me that my daughter had severe anger issues and that after she resolved those, she would be able to introduce some of those things. This was at least 6 or 8 months after she started seeing her. But she started talking with emancipation with my daughter 1 month after seeing my daughter and speaking to her. I never threatened her once. I only made a statement after she wrote the letter to the court saying that I would raise this issue with the professional board because I thought her recommendations were uninformed and reckless. She even admitted during her testimony that even after advising my daughter on emancipation for more than 6 months, that she didn't know what emancipation really was about other than a basic definition. She had no idea how my daughter was going to support herself. The commissioner, based solely on her testimony, he cited it in his order, awarded temporary custody, taking my daughter out of my home, and propelled me now into several months worth of court cases while I try to undo the damage she's done. She has driven a wedge between my daughter by sharing my unfiltered emails to her about what was going on with my daughter directly with her, which my daughter told me she shared them openly. She never informed me she would do something like this. She has spent her time in court criticizing my home, making statements about my home, saying that my home environment hindered my daughter's trauma recovery. That was the first time after 10 months of counseling and dozens of emails back and forth that I'd ever heard anything like that. If this was something that was hindering my daughter's recovery, why did it take a court hearing for her to suggest this? And for her to openly talk about my daughter's mental health issues with a third party with no release. She chose to insert herself into this case. She made recommendations that were uninformed and unfounded. And because of this, she has caused significant damage to my relationship with my daughter and significant damage to my daughter's recovery. And I'm asking the board to investigate it. You have her testimony, a transcript, you have all of the emails, all correspondence was done by email. So everything is available for review. And I'll let you guys, thank you for your time.
Great, thank you, JD. We may have some questions for you.
Sure.
Members, do you have any questions for JD? Dr. Stewart?
Not at this time, Chair. I would reserve the right to ask questions later on.
All right, thank you. Dr. Medina?
Do have one. Thank you for being here, JD. I understand that when your daughter started treatment, there was shared custody and she spent half the time at your home and half the time at the mother's home. Who had the ultimate say in medical treatment? for the daughter.
It was shared.
It is shared, but there is also a stipulation where it says if there is a disagreement, who would have the ultimate decision making.
Our custody agreement is fully shared decision making. There is no final decision maker. Both parents have to agree, in other words.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
JD, I have a few questions for you. Did you ever meet with Dr. Moeller for her to gain information from you regarding your relationship with the daughter? Can you just kind of summarize what your interaction was with her as far as did you go in clinically at all and have interaction with her?
There was no interaction other than email. We had one joint phone call where my daughter's mother and I and the victim's advocate during the trial from the trauma was present with Dr. Moeller. Other than that, I said hi to her when I dropped my daughter off, or usually just said pleasantries when their session was over. I typically had a work call when the session started, and I would just drop my daughter in, check her in, and then go outside to take the call.
So was it your understanding then that this counseling was strictly for the daughters and not necessarily, and I understand you and her mother or not together, but that it wasn't be like a family counseling or any type of counseling with you and her to help remediate some of the issues?
We were not there for family counseling in any sense. It was supposed to be focused on trauma only. In fact, that was an insistence that the mother placed on the sessions, and that also that any communications involved both parents, that there were no soul meetings.
Got it. Okay.
Which I agreed to.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Sure. And I don't have any further questions. Colleagues, do you have any further questions before we move? All right. Thank you, JD. If you could just put yourself on mute, we're going to now move to Dr. Moeller. And I do believe you are represented by an attorney. If you both could introduce yourselves for the record and unmute yourselves.
I'm Dr. Sue Moeller.
My name is Joe Shank. I'm the attorney for Dr. Moeller.
Mr. Shank, thank you both for being here. We appreciate it. I would like to give you a few minutes to do an opening statement or summary, either of you or one of you, whichever you prefer.
I will go ahead and I'll make a statement. In speaking with parents initially, they did make it very clear the focus of sessions was for individual therapy. There had been some other experiences previously that had made it difficult. So the focus was very individual. As JD said, it was very focused on trauma. In sharing information from parents' emails to the client, I had only done it one or two times before JD set the boundary and requested not to share it. And I was very mindful of respecting that boundary he set. So unless it was a concern he had brought forward, I did not share anything that was in the email after the initial first or second time. With meeting with the parents, I did offer to meet with both parents. Either they can meet separately or together. I had given multiple different times that were open for parents to meet. Mother chose to meet with me individually. Father, at that point, did not choose to meet with me. The agency does have a sliding scale policy that if a client has been emancipated or they turn 18, they do not have insurance or they're not able to afford it, the insurance doesn't cover. We do have a sliding scale that is offered. The note that parent said, the collaborative one that was complaining about having to pay, that had been waived. So there was no fee charged for that. There was no request to me either verbally or written to request the medical records. Medical records were released for the purposes of today, but also a best interest attorney had provided ROIs, and the medical record was sent for that. I did not advise the client on emancipation. The client brought that towards the appointments. And there was a release for the guardian ad litem. And that's all.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Schenck, did you have any comments?
I just had a couple of few, and it's just filling some gaps. First of all, I heard the complainant say that there was never any meeting until later when the emancipation was being conducted. But if you look at the records that were submitted with our response, you'll see that there was, in fact, immediately shortly after the first session with the client, there was a 28-minute video conference with both complainant and the client's mother to sort of set the ground rules and give them an opportunity to indicate what their understanding or expectations were. Secondly, the idea that my client injected herself into the emancipation procedure is proceeding is absolutely incorrect. It was discussed by the client on a few occasions during sessions, and Dr. Moeller never rendered any opinions as to whether she was in favor or against it, or supported it or anything of that nature. There was no involvement in the proceeding until the appointed guardian ad litem for the client contacted Dr. Moeller and asked for her to render an opinion or to testify in the emancipation proceeding. Dr. Moeller indicated that she would not testify without, being compelled to do so by a subpoena. She also, after being contacted, requested and secured a written release by the client's mother to communicate with the guardian ad litem. And it was after she got that release that she provided the two paragraph to whom it may concern letter and gave it solely to the guardian ad litem, which was, of course, the client's legal representative, and she had the release from the mother. She then had hoped that she could avoid testifying, but the guardian subpoenaed her. She was then in court ordered to testify. And at the hearing, the transcripts in the record, you can see that she said that she had no knowledge or opinion regarding whether or not the client was financially capable of emancipation. She just simply concluded that psychologically, it would be beneficial for the client's mental health. And finally, ultimately, this whole notion that she had refused to meet with the complainant is belied by the fact that there are emails exchanged where when a complainant requested a meeting, Dr. Moeller responded via email immediately that, yes, she would be happy to meet and here are some times. And then the complaint dropped it and never followed up.
All right. Thank you. Members of the board, do you have any questions for Dr. Moeller? Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Moeller, so you held according to the attorney, you held a 28-minute video chat with both parents shortly after the first initial meeting?
Correct.
Okay. And the JD alleges that you injected yourself voluntarily into the emancipation process. And I heard from you and your attorney that you only responded and made an opinion after you received the request from the guardian ad litem. Is that correct?
That is correct. The client talked about it, but I did not bring the subject up.
Good. So I'll follow up with that if I may. So to the best of your recollection, you did not bring up an issue of emancipation with the client?
No, I did not.
She brought that into the treatment room?
She did. And I told her I didn't know anything. That is not something I'm familiar with. And she did research outside.
And you received a release of information, a signed release of information from the mother authorizing you to speak with the GAL?
Correct.
Did you know that there was joint custody?
I did not know that both of them had to sign because mother is the only one that signed the paperwork for services.
So mother was the only one that signed for treatment to begin?
Mm-hmm. With the previous clinician.
I heard from JD that he agreed with treatment for the daughter to be seen initially. Is that accurate?
I think he signed it after. So the client started with Dr. Lane, the previous therapist working with the agency. Mother signed the paperwork. JD did not sign the paperwork until September.
Okay.
I believe.
So the letter, the to whom it may concern letter, did you, and I read in your response that you did not make any recommendations regarding custody, and yet at the same time, it seems like the emancipation letter would make an impact on custody. Is that your understanding, or did you think it would not?
I understood that the emancipation was separate from the custody hearings and had a different judge and different proceedings.
Did you think it would have any impact on your client in terms of relationships with either parent?
No, because at that point, the relationships were already strained with both parents.
And your information about the father and stepmother came solely from the client?
Correct. I never met the stepmother. She was never in the office.
Did you render a description or an opinion about the father's home, the complainant's home, and the stepmother?
I did not on the stepmother because I didn't know enough, just on the home and how it affected my client's mental health.
So you didn't make a statement that the stepmother referred to the client as the father's daughter?
That was in a text message that was also sent via email from parents as well.
Did you think, again, we're familiar with that slippery slope going from a clinical case and sliding into a forensic case? And looking back on it now, would you do the same thing again?
No, I think I would try to stay out of it. And I did consult with our compliance team and kind of did consult within the agency with our compliance team and sought help with one of the attorneys who's employed by our company.
Was that after the fact?
Yes, after the emancipation had been, the client had done the documents and the first one.
So before rendering the letter and your endorsement of the client's mental health and emancipation issue, you did not consult with the agency attorney or with professional staff members?
Comments? No, I did consult with professional staff.
How did that go?
It went difficult. We were trying to discuss whether it would fall under the forensic and kind of the court. And how we discussed it was we felt that it fell on the line of providing support for the client's mental health and advocate and helping the client advocate for their mental health.
And you gave the letter after that consultation, you authored the 2-paragraph letter of support, and you gave that to the GAL?
Correct. The GAL asked for me to write up a short statement after the conversation.
Did you think at that point, giving something to an attorney, that that might raise the question about it being a forensic case?
I did, and I, again, did consult with our compliance team. And what I had written, they did not feel that it would fall under a forensic.
That's all the questions I have right now, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Medina, do you have any questions?
I do. I have a question for Dr. Mohler. Can you talk about any training, supervision, or experience you've had in the past in providing an evaluation or professional opinion on emancipation cases?
I have not had any trainings. It was more consulting with fellow staff, the other doctors who work, and our compliance team. And then the attorney, once the subpoena was issued, on kind of what could and could not be shared.
Thank you. That was my question.
Dr. Mohler, could you just reiterate? So mothers signed the first, the paperwork at the original, and then you said father signed in September. September what year?
I thought he did. It would have been September of 2021.
Okay, September 2021, then father signed. Okay, so both parents.
I believe.
All right, so both parents have both joint physical and legal custody of the child. Your letter was written to the court in May. So father did not provide consent for you to provide anything to the GAL. Is that correct?
That is correct. Just mother had. And I checked our records, the file. I don't believe dad ever signed the releases of information through our company. I believe it was only mother that had.
All right. And then did you inquire, as you know, both parents aren't together, a copy of the custody paperwork, or to determine who has legal authority to sign and provide approval for treatment?
It had not been obtained by our company, no.
Was it obtained by you?
No, it was not.
And just to confirm, what is your understanding of the GAL's role in this situation and their authority?
The understanding I have and how they described it to me was as a representative to voice the client's position in whatever it is. I've worked with them before in California, and theirs was to be the voice for the client in court.
And can you explain, you said that with the emancipation, your thought was that you thought it was a good idea for that from a mental health situation, she was ready for that. Can you explain that, how you determined her that it would be okay for her to have that emancipation? What was it you were representing?
That her mental health, she was struggling to stay balanced because she kept becoming triggered by the situations, and that if she was able to be removed from the physical situations, that it would allow her to kind of work at a faster rate and be able to process some of those things.
And how would being on her own, getting a job, paying rent, insurance, you know, all the things that we all deal with in life, how did you assess all that impact on her mental health when she is no longer has necessarily a, and I don't know if she had a plan, you know, if she has money or whatever, but what assessment did you do to ensure that she would be able to handle all those adult?
We explored the support system that she would have, friends, extended family that she could search out for assistance and providing that support for her. At least the mental aspect of it. I did not look at her employment. I knew school was going well. She excels at school. She likes school. It is a safe place for her.
But knowing that, I mean, part of mental health is like, there's other stresses in life, right? I mean, what if someone can't take her in, or there's other issues? So you didn't evaluate how she would deal with those.
She had multiple places she could go for. She had a backup plan if the first one fell through, and had what she had indicated had spoken with them multiple times and had worked out a plan.
Okay, great. All right, thank you. Members of the board, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know if Mr. Shep could handle this question, or Dr. Mueller. Let me just ask it and see. Is there any indication that there is joint 50-50 decision making in the custody arrangement for medical services, and that there is not the ultimate decision maker? Is that in the custody arrangement?
I don't know that that's in it. We don't have the court documents, so I don't know for sure. I can only go by what parents have said.
Well, the father just testified that he understood the custody arrangement to be 50-50, and that there was no ultimate decision maker for medical services.
Correct.
For the attorney.
But he had never mentioned that to me previously.
So you understood that the mother was the ultimate decision maker?
I understood that either one could make a decision.
But you didn't look at any custody agreement to get that information?
No, it had not been provided.
You did not request that?
No.
For a minor in treatment? Perfect. I don't know if the attorney would like to say anything to that.
Here's what I can add to that, which is, as Dr. Mueller mentioned, when the client was originally signed in to become a client of the agency, only the mother signed the documents. The father was obviously aware that his daughter was receiving treatment by the agency, because he's already testified or mentioned that he was frequently the one who brought her to the sessions. He participated jointly with his former wife in a 28-minute session at the very outset of Dr. Mueller's treatment, and raised no objections to the fact that she was seeing his daughter without him having signed the paperwork. So I think that if nothing else, there was an implied consent by the father for treatment, because he was bringing her to the treatment. As he mentioned, participated in the 28-minute conference call, and at no time saw fit to indicate that he did not believe that Dr. Mueller had authority to provide treatment or anything of that type because of his participation in the process.
Thank you. A follow-up question for Dr. Mueller. Since this occurrence, has your agency taken any steps to remediate the intake process, that especially in a joint custody, to at least get paperwork of who can authorize treatment?
Yes, they have.
And can you explain that a little bit to me? What?
So the policy has been changed. So if we have a client who is a minor and parents are separated, we do request that they bring in the court order so that it can be in our documents. So we know ultimately, is it both that share complete 50-50? Does one parent hold medical kind of consent, or is there an ultimate decision maker?
Thank you. That's all of my questions, Chair.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Hearing none. Dr. Mueller, thank you for being here, and Mr. And also your attorney for being here. We are now going to enter into deliberations. Please note, this is a time for the committee members to talk amongst ourselves. Wait, before we go into deliberations, Ms. Galvin, I have a legal question. Should we go into exec session? I want to call for exec session. Should I do that now or can we do that in deliberations?
No, you're free to move for executive session at this time.
Okay. I would motion to go into exec session for a legal advice.
Second.
You got a motion, a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. All right. Welcome back. We are all back. We're now back in open session. The committee will now begin deliberations. Please note that deliberations is only for the committee members to talk amongst each other without any interruption from anybody. Dr. Stewart, you are the lead. Would you like to just start the deliberations?
Yes, Chair. It's certainly clear that this is a that fine line between treatment and treatment cases, treatment considerations, and forensic considerations. In my opinion, it did slide into a forensic case when the letter was issued to whom it may concern. I have trouble with the agency per se in not requiring, you know, some type of documentation of who the final decision maker would be in health services. And so ultimately, Dr. Moeller, I guess, has to shoulder that responsibility. But I think as the way that the case has evolved and presented, I think she tried her best to thread the needle and walk that fine tightrope in this particular situation. I think, unfortunately, it did slip into some forensic concerns, and that is troubling for sure. But that's something that can be, she's already taken corrective action with the agency. She's consulted with the agency attorney as well as professional staff after the fact. She consulted with professional staff prior to rendering the to whom it may concern letter. And so that's certainly in her favor. But ultimately, there's a lack of training and education. If you're going to tread in those waters of forensic cases, you need to have the adequate training.
Thank you. Dr. Molina, would you like to go next or want me to?
I can go. I concur with Dr. Stewart. I think that there are certain things that the agency at the onset of treatment failed to do. It seems that there has been corrected action in regards to that, but you know, ultimately, I think it then falls on Dr. Mueller's to make sure not only that the documentation for the case is in order, but, you know, in issuing the letter, I think it sort of crossed that boundary. There is a sentence in the letter that is a standard, you know, a long sentence. I am in support of her emancipation. And that seems an umbrella statement written in that letter. It wasn't with specificity to mental health, the mental health of the minor in this case. So I concur with Dr. Stewart. I think there is certainly some concerns with sort of that training or crossing into that realm of forensic psychology.
I would agree with you both. I do find it a little bit taken back that proper consent wasn't given, that you brought in a minor was brought into an organization where they knew that the parents weren't together and that, you know, no one looked at the custody rights, you know, and they just assumed, although father did or I think it was Dr. Mueller, stated later that father signed, I guess, in September. The letter was issued to the guardian ad litem after that, and the Dr. Mueller did not consult with either parent regarding that letter. And so there was no, even though both parents now have signed with the agency, state and as parents, there is no consultation with the parents in regards to that letter. I feel as though she was somewhat practicing outside of her scope, in that to prove emancipation without any training, understanding, I mean, well, she might, you know, the idea that, oh, she might do better, but that's a big scope. I mean, you give someone, if she was allowed that emancipation, how is she, from a bigger picture, going to handle everything? And it just doesn't seem like that was taken into consideration. I do feel it somewhat crossed over to forensics. So I do have some strong concerns on how this was handled. I do feel like there were some violations of our rules and statutes. I would submit that we move this forward to the full board. I don't know how you feel, Dr. Stewart.
I would make that motion, Madam Chair, to move it to the full board. I think a non-disciplinary letter of concern or something like that would be appropriate. Maybe at the full board meeting, to require, additional CEUs and forensic training, perhaps. But I wouldn't be comfortable right here dismissing the case. I'm leaning in that direction. And yet at the same time, it did occur, and there, you know, it's as unfair as what it is to Dr. Mueller. From the agency standpoint, the agency failed in its intake to do this. And yet, unfortunately, it falls to Dr. Mueller being the responsible person in the treatment dyad, for client and therapist. So I move to refer this to the full board. I don't know, Ms. Galvin, if I can.
Well, can we have a further discussion?
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yes. So I would somewhat respectfully disagree. I do think that Dr. Mueller made, you know, there were some, as a psychologist, you're responsible for ensuring that you have the proper documentation needed to serve a client. And that, you know, I guess, you know, the organization may bring it, you know, handle the paperwork, but that should have been known to this individual, to the doctor. And when she wrote a letter, I don't think that, including the parents, I mean, that was a decision point. She made professional decisions based on this child, on this minor, on the emancipation, went to court and gave those opinions that I feel like it was out of her realm, out of her training. I wouldn't agree with the letter, potentially with a non-disciplinary letter. I don't think you can do a non-disciplinary letter and CE credits attached to it. So I would agree that there's a violation. Do you want, I could express the ones I feel there's a violation of, Dr. Stewart, if you'd like me to do that.
Please.
Right. Can we clarify, the motion, Dr. Stewart, is to move it to the full board. Does your motion include a recommendation for a letter of concern, a non-disciplinary CE, or is your motion limited to referral to the full board?
My motion is limited to referral to the full board. My offhanded comment would be that for CE attachments and a non-disciplinary letter.
But is that your motion? I mean, it needs to be, we need to know what your motion is. You can't do it on the side. It's like, what is your
other? Yeah. Let me step up then to the plate. I move that we move this to the full board with a recommendation for a non-disciplinary letter of concern.
And will that also include a non-disciplinary order for continuing education? The committee could recommend both or just one.
Exactly what Ms. Knuckleson said.
And is there a second for that?
Second.
Ms. Galvin, do we need to notate potential violations?
Well, if they're recommending a non-disciplinary letter of concern and a non-disciplinary CE order, that implies that there are no violations or recommended violations. But because this is a possible referral, we could include those so as to give proper notice to the licensee once it gets to the board.
All right. So we have a motion and a second. We'll have discussions. I don't agree. I won't support the motion. I do believe that there's a violation of 32-2061-16G, engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with the psychologist's professional education, training, and experience. I do think a psychologist as a basic should understand what, you know, and have looked at the custody and understand the roles of both the parents and the rights of both the parents. I do feel as though when she stepped out and started and wrote a letter to the guardian ad litem regarding emancipation, she stepped out of her training. She stated in her comments that she doesn't have any training in that background, you know, any training in emancipation or any of that. I feel like she stepped out of that. And also, I do believe, and then that would be also potentially the ethical code of boundaries of competence. I think she's also stepped out of her area of competence and understanding. So I don't agree that it would go to the board for just a non-disciplinary CEU. I just make that comment. I do have a question for Ms. Galvin. If this motion goes to the board, can the board change the motion when it gets there?
Of course. They are not bound by a recommendation from the complaint screening committee.
All right.
So, I would prefer, in order to give the licensee notice once it does go to the board, that staff include the violations or potential violations that were cited in the investigative report, so that the licensee is provided some sort of notice in the event that the board does not accept the recommendation.
I would agree to that.
I agree with that.
All right. Dr. Medina, are you okay? All right, so we have a motion and a second. Is anyone have any further discussion? All right, all in favor to the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Dr. Medina.
Yeah, Dr. Medina, we need a, you can go either for it or against it. I don't know if you're on mute. Can you speak for me?
I am. Can you hear?
Now I can. So let me redo this. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Nay. So is it, or do you oppose, Ms. Dr. Medina?
So yes, after hearing, you know, what you brought up, I do agree that there is a violation that I think that there is a violation that took place.
So from a procedural standpoint, the motion fails. Right. So now we need a new motion. So I am going to make a motion that we move this to the full board with a potential violation of ARS 32-2061-16, which is unprofessional conduct. And I think it was G, engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with the psychologist's professional education, training, and experience. And Ms. Galvin, I was trying to find one. I thought there was something about record keeping, because I thought not having the correct.
If you're talking about lacking informed consent.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So that would be a violation of DD, an ethical code adopted by the board. And informed consent is.
That's what I was looking
for. Oh, R? Is that R?
I'm looking in the code of conduct right now.
Yes, R, actually. Failing to obtain a client or patient's informed or written consent to release personal or otherwise confidential information to another party unless the release is otherwise authorized by law.
And then
you can cite R, and then it would probably be advisable to cite DD and the ethical code.
And under the ethical code, the informed consent is section 3.10 for reference.
Okay. So just to confirm, I would like to move it to the board for the possible violation of ARS 32-2061, 16G, with R, that's regarding the informed consent, DD, which is a violation of ethical board standards adopted by the board, and that would be ethical code number 3.10, informed consent.
Ms. Shreve, I remember earlier you had mentioned
2.01, boundaries of competence.
Okay, you made a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you all for participating. You'll be informed in writing by our board of what the next move it through the process is and when this will be placed on a board agenda. So thank you for attending today. We're going to move to our second case today, and it is case number 2310 for Dr. Heather Young. Dr. Medina, you are the lead on this case. Would you like to provide a summary?
Yes. Can you hear me? Okay, good. So I'm giving a brief overview of the complaint, number 2310 against Dr. Heather Young, holder of license number 5294. Dr. Young graduated from the California Institute of Integral Studies in 2016 and has been licensed by our board since September 8, 2020. On September 9th, 2022, the board received a complaint by email from KO regarding services Dr. Young had provided to his girlfriend, whom I'll refer to as client moving forward. KO was not Dr. Young's patient. KO shared in the complaint that the client had sought therapy with Dr. Young after the passing of several of her friends and was dealing with grief and depression issues. KO's complaint centers around unprofessional things that Dr. Young would tell the client about extraterrestrial activity, that then the client would rely to him after meeting with Dr. Young. KO also includes in the complaint that client terminated services due to Dr. Young's unprofessional behavior. Other than the complaint, there was no other documentation provided to the board by KO. Dr. Young is a licensed psychologist in private practice, and in the response provided to the board, she denied the allegations and provided documentation of the treatment and therapy sessions.
Thank you very much for the summary. All right, is the complainant KO present today?
I do not see him present, Madam Chair. He did previously indicate he would be attending, but I followed up with him this morning and I never heard back. So
all right,
go ahead and hear from the licensee and her attorney.
All right, I'm just gonna give one more call out to KO. All right, now we're gonna move to Dr. Young, and I do believe you are, you do have an attorney, Mr. Eves.
Good morning, Ms. Shreve, members of the committee.
If you could both introduce yourselves officially for the record, and then if you want to give an opening statement, that would be great.
Absolutely. So this is Artie Eves, and I'm here with my client, Dr. Young, and she's prepared a brief statement within 5 minutes to give to the board.
Okay. Good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee on this issue. I'm going to make a brief statement, and then I welcome any questions that you might have. So I began seeing the client, I'll just refer to her as EL, in January of 2021. And we worked together for a year and a half through June 2022, for a total of 103 sessions. From my perspective, we had a very good working relationship and we were making good progress. She exhibited symptoms of complex trauma, anxiety, depression, and she was also dealing with significant grief, complex bereavement related to the recent deaths of several friends, and managing her current difficult relationships with her parents and other members of her extended family. A deeply spiritually oriented person, spiritual topics were woven throughout the course of therapy, in large part in response to attempting to cope with grief she was experiencing, and the existential anxiety the losses brought up in her. I provided the email that she sent when she left therapy, naming no complaints whatsoever, thanking me and stating that she felt that she had grown. Nor did she express anything but appreciation for me and for the therapy throughout our work together. Therefore, I could not have been more surprised when I received the complaint in this case. I'm always bothered when I hear a current or a former client is struggling, and I do wish she would continue therapy with me or with someone else. I do have to say that the allegations brought by her boyfriend could not have been more shocking to me. I don't want to engage in speculation as to what might motivate someone to say those things. What I can tell you is that I absolutely never discussed those topics with her. This was a young woman dealing with complex trauma related to her religious upbringing, past and current family dynamics, and the recent deaths of several friends. She was experiencing a spiritual crisis and making a break from the religious values held by her family. And she did that in her career choice, studying traditional Chinese medicine after having dropped out of nursing school, and in the development of her spirituality, independent from her very restrictive Christian upbringing. She was seeking truth. She was seeking to find out what she believed about herself, other people, the world, the nature of the universe. There were a couple of occasions where she brought up aliens and how they might fit into her beliefs about spirituality, whether they were real, given recent mainstream news articles on them, and if so, whether they might be threatening or a benefit to humanity. These were passing conversations. They were in no way any kind of a focus in the therapy sessions. We really focused on developing discernment for her, because trusting herself and her own sense of things was something that she really struggled with, which was an effect of her upbringing. And we focused on finding cognitive and emotional balance in relationship to topics in which she may never know the truth, and in what allowed her to feel safe, protected, and grounded. I'm sure you can relate. A lot of clients have scars from involvement with religious institutions from their childhood, and who seek help with this spiritual existential level. And this was a patient who was dealing with those issues. And I do have experience, training, and interest in dealing with those issues. In my practice with patients like this, there are a few principles I adhere to. This is not an exhaustive discussion of how I approach these issues. I'm just trying to give you a basic sense of this so you can ask me more questions if you'd like. I work to demonstrate empathy, warmth, respect, curiosity, appreciation for their lived experiences, their practices, their perspective, in the same way that I would attend to other important issues of their lives. I encourage clients to develop discernment regarding the sources of their information or practices, while also fostering confidence in their own beliefs. I help people to make meaning of and understand the nature of their spiritual experiences. For example, exploring how their spiritual experiences connect to their past and current life experiences, and whether their particular engagements with religion and spirituality are beneficial and enhance their coping, or whether they are harmful to them. EL brought up many different topics related to spirituality during her sessions, such as speaking to mediums regarding the work of, reading the work of channelers, whether there is life after death, different spiritual gurus she felt connected with, her newfound belief in reincarnation, various rituals she had participated in, which included the use of psychedelics, Christian teaching she loved and agreed with, and those she found problematic. With this client, because she'd been through traumatic spiritual experiences, she may have been more susceptible actually to charlatans, which is part of why I focused so much on discernment with her, such as how to evaluate the value of a teacher, a book, any source of information. Her grief was causing her to be focused on her spirituality even more intensely than she usually would be. It explained why she was fascinated with the idea of mediums as a way to connect with people she had lost and make meaning of their untimely deaths and the effect of these deaths on her personally. It was important for her to figure out what she believed about life and the universe to deal with her grief, including deciding that she believed in reincarnation, which is a comforting idea when questioning whether a deceased friend is just gone or if their existence continues. In the bigger picture, I recognize the development of a client's relationship to religion, spirituality, and faith as undergoing developmental changes over the span of a lifetime. And this client was experiencing the individuation reflection stage, which according to Fowler's model of faith maturation, is one stage in that process. And she was experiencing angst in that stage. From a more contemporary model of spiritual transformation, the client was also engaged in a life as practice where she was integrating her spiritual understanding into her daily life in a seamless way and moving more from an I to a we perspective in her orientation. So she was really working toward becoming more compassionate and altruistic, and that those motivations were as important as attending to her own needs and desires. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. And at this point, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the board members?
I do not have any.
Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Young, thank you for that opening statement. So the complainant, it was a boyfriend of your client. Is that correct?
Correct.
Your client was how old? How old is your client?
25, I believe. 20. Okay. Yeah.
And she had dropped out of nursing school and was pursuing training in Chinese medicine?
Correct.
I apologize in advance for the question, but did you try to indoctrinate her into believing in alien existences and non-Christian concepts?
No, I did not. No.
Did you ever meet with KO in conjunction with your client or separately?
Yes, he did come to one session in service of her therapy and to give kind of his perspective on, her, what she was dealing with, that kind of thing.
What's your impression of that session?
Dr. Stewart and Dr. Young, if we're going to speak specifically about a session, perhaps it would be best to go into executive session.
Madam Chair, I recommend that we go into executive session to talk about sensitive and confidential information.
All right. Is that a motion?
Yes, ma'am.
And is there a second?
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All right, so we are going to push the join button. All right, we're back in open session. Are there any further questions for Dr. Young?
I'm ready to make a motion.
We're going to move into deliberations.
Okay.
And then you can, we're going to move into deliberations. This is a time for us to talk amongst ourselves or make a motion. So is there any comments first before a motion? Dr. Medina? Dr. Medina, this is your case, so I'm going to let you start the discussions.
I don't see any violations in this case, so I really don't have any further comments. And if Dr. Sewell wants to make the motion, he can, or I can make it, whatever works.
It's your case, Dr. Medina. Please make the motion.
Ms. Reeve, any other comments before?
No, I would concur with you.
Okay, so
I do have a motion, and I move that complaint number 2310 be dismissed as there is no evidence of violation of statutes or rules by the licensee.
Second.
All right, we have a motion, a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. So Dr. Young, you'll be hearing from, I guess, whatever follow-up paperwork there is with the with our office. So thank you. We do thank you for being here, and Mr. Eaves for being here with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr.
Young. Thank you, Mr. Eaves.
We're going to move now to our next case. Is case 23-11. Dr. Is it Corsten?
Yes. And Dr. I'm sorry, Ms. Shreve. I am also representing Dr. Corsten. Can I have 30 seconds so that Dr. Young can leave the room and then we can.
Yeah, why don't we just take like a, can we take a 5-minute break? You want to just take a 5-minute break, please? All right, so we are going to reconvene at 10 o'clock. So go ahead and turn off your cameras, mics, and we will be. Everybody is back. We're going to move to our next case, 2311, for Dr. Corsten. Dr. Corsten is here. Dr. Stewart, you are the lead. Would you like to provide a brief summary?
Yes, Chair. Thank you so much. Dr. Corsten, thank you for being here, Mr. Eaves as well. This is complaint number 2311. The licensee is Dr. Corsten, and the complainant is the mother. This has been, it looks like, an ongoing complicated, and I believe the phrase is high stakes, custody battle that's been going on for a while. Dr. Corsten was engaged, to provide services to the mother's son, regarding trauma. The complaint was filed, therapy was terminated August 5th, 2022. When mother withdrew her consent, as she believed Dr. Corsten failed to submit a DCS report after son reported to her a quote unquote new incident. And looks like August 8th, 3 days later, the mother filed a complaint against Dr. Corsten, alleging that she failed to act in her role as a mandated reporter. The complaint was sent to, Dr. Malott, Ms. Shreve, and myself for review. The claim again is failure to report as a mandated, reporter, and the respondent's response, the licensee's response, Dr. Corsten did supply her entire treatment record in a timely fashion. Licensee states that the complaint is without merit, and Dr. Corsten requests that it be dismissed. The mother's complaint has been, looks like, thoroughly investigated by DCS, that the mother has already contacted the son's pediatrician, school psychologists, and Phoenix Police, Scottsdale Police Departments, as well as DCS. So Dr. Corsten indicates that the complaints had already been filed with those departments, including the legal entities responsible for looking into those replies, allegations, and that they had been investigated. The licensee cites Dr. Robert DiCarlo's report to evaluate events discussed above. And I have reviewed Dr. DiCarlo's report, which is always well written and well received by the board. Part of Dr. DiCarlo's report is that the mother misrepresented the time frame of the complaints and has been problematic in that, and that the incidents have been fully investigated by DCS and the case has been closed. That ends my part.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you.
Is the complainant JP present? If you'd like to unmute yourself.
Yes, I am present.
All right, welcome. Thank you for being here today. I'd like to give you an opportunity to make a brief statement to the board.
Yes, thank you. One of the issues that was not mentioned that was also complained about was that Ms. Corsten violated her contract, her therapeutic contract, where it was she was not supposed to tell either myself or the child's father unless the child gave express permission. Whereas her notes and file could be turned over, there was a problem with violating my son's trust and basically undermining the entire therapeutic process. It took months to build any kind of rapport with my son, which I expressed my concerns that the father had told him he was not to discuss anything with her. And finally, when he was able to open up, she then went and told Mr. Lazara the details. My son then refused to go back to therapy. He's still currently refusing to go back to therapy because he is afraid that his trust will be violated again. I'm very upset. I would not have signed the contract to enter into her services had I known she was going to do that. Additionally, Dr. DiCarlo has all of his information from my ex-husband in regards to what the timeline of the incidents were. There were apparently an ongoing issue of abuse, and this was an entirely new incident. Ms. Corsten never read the records and didn't know which incidences had been disclosed and which ones had not. And unfortunately, Mr. DiCarlo is something of a biased witness, as my ex-husband is paying him to be a witness in a very contested custody matter that my ex-husband has initiated.
Thank you for your comments. Board members, any questions for JP?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
Dr. Medina, you're on mute.
Not at this time.
Okay, I do have a question. So JP, if you could just put in perspective, there was an incident that was reported to CPS and was investigated. Your son then mentions this situation with his, I believe, his stepbrother to the doctor. Was that a different incident or is that the same incident?
It was a different incident.
And was that when, is it your understanding that when your son mentioned it to the doctor, did he put a perspective on time frame or when it was?
I don't know what questions she asked him.
All right, thank you. Dr. Stewart?
Yes, Madam Chair, I appreciate the recognition here for a question. JP, has the case, the DCS case, has that been closed?
Yes, it was dismissed because it was referred to the police. And in part of that, there was a safety plan where my ex-husband was supposed to follow up on counseling for my son. And I have to note that he never once took the child to see Mr. Corsten, or see Dr. Corsten. And I'm sure she can document that as well.
A follow-up question. Was the police investigation closed?
Yes, they closed it after the interview with Child Help because the perpetrator was also a child who would not have requisite intent. And it was really a social work matter.
That's all of my questions, Madam Chair.
Yes, right. The DCS matter was closed because I was deemed to be the competent parent.
All right, thank you. We're going to now, are there any further questions for JP? All right, hearing none, we're going to, if we go to Dr. Corsten, and I believe you're also represented by Mr. Eaves. If you could both officially introduce yourselves for the record.
Yes, Ms. Reed, thank you very much again. I'm Artie Eaves, and I'm representing Dr. Corsten, who is appearing by Zoom, and she has a statement prepared.
Great, thank you.
Hi there, everyone. I'm Dr. Corsten. So good morning. Thank you all for allowing me to address the board today. This was a high conflict divorce situation that continues to be in litigation. I've been subpoenaed to testify on the matter in March. My first contact with the family occurred in February 2022 when the attorneys reached out to me regarding therapy for the child. After father and mother both signed their consent forms, I proceeded to speak with mother, father, and the child separately. During the interviews, mother and father both mentioned that there had been sexual abuse allegations against the child by the same age perpetrator, the stepbrother who was living in father's home. I believe both children were 6 or 7 at the time. Both parents told me that DCS and police had been involved in December 2021, and they both had unsubstantiated and closed out their cases. Following my interview with the child, I let both attorneys know that the child did not disclose any issues related to the abuse at all, so therapy would likely not be helpful in this regard. I did mention, though, that it may be helpful for him to get therapy just for the high conflict situation between the parents. My parents then agreed to move forward with therapy, and I had a conference call with the attorneys in March. They both mentioned DCS and police had unsubstantiated any abuse allegations and closed out the case. The parents agreed to have the child start therapy at the end of March, and then in July, the child reported that his stepbrother had touched his privates on 2 occasions, quote-unquote, a long time ago. Because I know children have difficulty with time frames, I asked him, did this happen before therapy started? He said yes. The child reported 2 incidents of his stepbrother touching his privates, quote unquote, for like a second each time. He said after the second time, he reported it to mother and stepmother, and then he said it never happened again after that. When asked what made him feel safe enough to tell me now, he said that his mom, my mom told me to tell you. Immediately following the session, my mother had brought the child to therapy that day, and she's correct. She had brought him every day that I had seen him. And I had spoken with her about the disclosure. I had taken notes during that discussion with mother. During that discussion, she said that child had gotten interviewed by Child Help. She also had mentioned that it had been reported to DCS and the police already. She said she did not want me to tell father that the child was discussing this issue in therapy for fear of retaliation. I told her that I couldn't keep information like that from father. She asked me to wait a week because they were going on vacation. And so I did decide to just let the attorneys know. And then I contacted father a week later to try and work with mother in that regard. So I did email the attorneys. I again clarified, it's my understanding this has already been investigated. Father's attorney emailed me back saying, yes, this was closed out a long time ago and it had been investigated. Mother then emailed me the next day, please report to DCS for your license, which confused me given that she had already told me this had been reported when I met with her in person the day prior. If I felt like this was a new incident, I absolutely would have reported it. I make several reports a year to DCS with my line of work. I had 3 sources telling me that this had already been reported, and 1 source mom seemed to be inconsistent in her reports to it. On August 1st, I had my last session with the child, and he started talking about a time that his uncle had pushed father into a glass table and it shattered. The child reported the incident happened many, many years ago. I asked him why this was coming up now, and he said that his mom wanted him to discuss it, although it was not bothering him. We role-played ways to tell mom about bringing up past instances that do not bother him. The child told me, quote-unquote, she does that. I asked whether he would give me permission to talk to mother about this, and he said no, so I did not discuss it with her. On August 3rd, I spoke with father, which was approximately a week later. Father confirmed that child was reporting the same incidences. The next day, father asked me to release my records. I asked mom whether or not this was okay. She said yes. And the same day, she withdrew her consent for me to see the child, saying he was fearful of retaliation from father. It should be noted that at no time did the child report any negative experiences with either parent. I also asked him about any issues that had came up during the vacation with dad. He said nothing occurred. He had a great time with dad. There was never any fear reported. Mother also didn't permit me to have a termination session with the child when I asked, and wouldn't permit me to write a letter saying goodbye, so that the therapy was terminated after that August 1st session. Thank you so much.
May I continue?
No, JP, we've already spoken with you. This is our time now to speak to the doctor. So please put yourself on mute. I'd appreciate it. Thank you. So are there any questions for the doctor from the board members? Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Corson, thank you for being here today. I have a couple of questions. So you understood that the incidents reported by the child that required you as a mandated reporter to report to DCS. Your understanding is that they had already been reported to both DCS and the police department?
Yes.
And at that time, because of the tender age, the same age alleged perpetrator, is your understanding that that's why the DCS complaint was dismissed?
Yes.
And that there was no criminal intent?
Correct.
And the new session that, the new complaint that JP, that the mother alleges, after the fact, is there an understanding that it's by the same person, another child of the same age?
It was the same person. It was his stepbrother that was living at father's home.
Okay. Now, why you terminated the sessions with the child? Because mother withdrew her consent?
Correct.
Those are all my questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Medina?
I don't have any questions at this time.
I have a question. Could you tell us what your understanding is your, as far as your requirement to report as a psychologist?
If I have a reasonable belief that there was abuse that had occurred, there had been abuse, but it was very clear to me, given the attorney calls, given what mother had reported, what father had reported, what mother reported right after the session with the child, that it had already been disclosed to DCS and police, and they had investigated, and both agencies had closed out their case.
All right. And you weren't concerned that it was a new situation, that it was clear to you based on what was stated?
Right. Yeah. I did not think it was a new situation. If I did, I would have absolutely reported it.
All right. Thank you. Those were my questions. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Chair. And just to clarify, and I think the attorney, Mr. Eaves, included an addendum that if a known case has already been reported, then there's not an obligation to re-report the same incident. Is that my understanding, either the attorney or the psychologist?
Yes, Dr. Stewart, I'm happy to address that. That's correct. So I did some research in preparation for, assisting with drafting that response. And that is the way that the statute works. So a reasonable belief gives rise to an obligation to report, but there is an exception if you know that the situation has already been reported, which it was clear to Dr. Corston that this situation had already been reported and investigated.
And I don't know if I can ask this question. I'd like to avoid going into executive session if I could, but if that's the understanding of our Associate Attorney General.
Dr. Stewart, yes, it is.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
That was the exact same question I was going to ask. Not that we, Mr. Eaves, don't take it personal. I just like to know, make sure our attorney you know, is seen in eye to eye, because we always know attorneys agree, right?
So, yeah, Ms. Galvin's, you know, a far better attorney than I am, so I understand.
All right, thank you. Dr. Medina, do you have any further questions?
I do not at this time.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Corson, JP, and Mr. Eves for being here today. We're going to go now into deliberations. This is a time for the board members to deliberate the case. Dr. Stewart, I believe you were the lead. If you'd like to start the deliberations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I really appreciate we absolutely must take and do these reports seriously. We have to fully investigate them because of our duty to protect the public. In this particular situation, I'm hard pressed to see any unethical conduct or any unprofessional conduct or any not living up to the required mandated reporter act. I'm just at a loss to, it seems like it's the same incident. And just simply hypothetically, even if it was a new incident, if it's the same age child and it's already been reported, I'm not seeing that it would have any different outcome. So those are my comments.
Dr. Medina?
I agree with Dr. Sword's view and opinion. I don't see that there is a violation of any rule or statute here.
Thank you. And I would agree. I think given the law that was presented, I mean, it seems like due diligence was made on Dr. Corson's by Dr. Corson in talking to this, and her notes show that it was prior to the counseling. And so appears as though she's correct. This has already been addressed. So I don't see any issue either. Is there a motion to be made?
Madam Chair, I move that we dismiss the complaint because of no findings.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the motion is, all in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes, and both parties will be receiving something from our board soon regarding the incident. So it's dismissed. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you, everyone. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Dr. Corson.
Thank you. Our next case is case number 23-06 for Dr. Paul, is it Knuckles?
Correct.
Okay. And Dr. Medina, you are the lead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I am giving a brief overview of the complaint 2310. Against Dr. Paul Knuckles, holder of license number 5040. Dr. Knuckles graduated from Northern Arizona University in 2015 and has been licensed in the state since November 8, 2018. On August 11th, 2022, the board received an anonymous complaint against Dr. Knuckles alleging that he is engaged in a dual romantic relationship with a previous client of his. The complaint included a printout of pictures from the client's Facebook, which included the client's daughter alongside Dr. Knuckles' daughter and another one of Dr. Knuckles by himself. The pictures were posted on July 30th, 2022. Dr. Knuckles saw the client for therapy from August 19th, 2019 to July 2022 for a total of 111 sessions. The board issued a subpoena for phone records. Data from Dr. Knuckles' cell phone number indicated that there were 122 text messages exchanged between October 1st, 2021 through July 15th, 2022, and 104 phone calls between January 4th, 2022 and July 15th, 2022. Dr. Knuckles addressed the complaint with a two-page letter on September 9th, 2022. And Dr. Knuckles complied with submitting the client records up on the board, the board staff request. Dr. Knuckles does not have any legal representation, and on a letter dated January 23rd, 2023, Dr. Knuckles informed the board that he would not be in attendance, stating that he would simply allow his license to be revoked. That concludes my summary.
Madam Chair, if I may just elaborate regarding Dr. Medina's comment. Yes, I did receive a letter yesterday afternoon from Dr. Knuckles, which is included in your materials. He indicated that he would not be attending today. His intention was to allow his license to be revoked and that he was wishing to pursue other professions outside of psychology. I did notify him by email that because he does have an active license, the board can continue their investigation to this complaint, regardless of whether he does attend or not. Of course, the committee may wish to get legal advice from Ms. Galvin with respect to how to proceed today.
Thank you. I would then motion to go into exec session to receive legal advice from our esteemed attorney. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion in 2 seconds. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, we're now going to push the leave button and go, mm-hmm. or no, we're going to do the join button as soon as we see it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure. So I'm going to open.
I am.
Perfect. Great. We are back together. We do not have the doctor here. So we are going to move into deliberations. It's time for us to deliberate this issue. Dr. Medina, you are the lead. Would you like to start the deliberations?
Yes. So, you know, I think this is a complicated case in part because it comes from a small town, from Flagstaff, right? And if you live there and you're a psychologist, you know a lot of people and a lot of people know you. And, you know, the pictures that were provided with the complaint did not indicate that there was necessarily, you know, like a romantic relationship. The children were the ones who were there, which, again, in a small town, I can certainly see how if you have a child, you know, and a client has a child the same age, you find yourselves in that situation. I'm concerned that there were no at the onset of treatment when the contract was signed, there are no stipulations or anything regarding communication via text or email, electronic, anything like that. And so, you know, to me, that is of concern. There was something else. I'm sorry. My mind. That, you know, some of the items that were added to the record were added, I think, after the record was requested and added to the record, and no note of discussing, you know, this situation, even if it's post-treatment with the mother, since the mother, you know, the client, right? And what that would look like, that the children were friends. I think it would have been wise perhaps to have a conversation and documented, even if it was like after treatment. Right. So to me, those would be my concerns. I don't think I would be in a position to say that there is like an inappropriate relationship. I don't have evidence of that, or a romantic relationship. I don't have evidence of that.
Right. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I absolutely concur with Dr. Medina. You know, the anonymous complaint and then photographs that really do not identify, we don't have proof that that's even the licensee or his children or anything else. We lack that. So the complaint, the major thing is the letter from Dr. Knuckles yesterday or day before that says he's not contesting things and he's accepting revocation. I think that's the most damning thing in this whole case, because certainly the anonymous complainant didn't provide any substantial documentation. My concern is that we certainly have to act on this, because the licensee is willing to have his license revoked while under investigation. And I think it does need to be moved to the full board with that consideration. And as we've already said, I'm certainly not willing to subpoena the patient in this case because of the fragile mental state that's implied.
Thank you. And I would concur, but I'd also add, though, I have concerns with the logs of the phone calls and the length of the phone calls and the amount of phone calls. I would have liked to just have had some explanation on those. And I do agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Medina that some of the records looked like they were updated after the complaint was filed, which is suspicious. You know, I'd like to have an explanation of that. And then obviously the informed consent for the texting and phone calls. So I do feel it warrants, like the both of you, that you should go to the full board. I think if we were to ask our attorney to move forward with a consent that allows him to revoke his license, and if that is not agreed to, then it goes to the board. Did you, Dr. Medina, did you want to make a recommendation on the violations, or would you like me to do that? Or
if you can do that, I'm trying to find which ones apply here, I think, in terms of documentation, for sure.
Well, I think so failing, or EH, so you have 32-2061-16. If you go H, failing or refusing to maintain it and retain adequate business, financial, professional records pertaining to psychology services provided to a client or patient. That includes those. And then I think possibly O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards and practice. And then DD, and I was trying to find one that deals with, I was trying to find the dual relationship. Maybe Ms. Galvin, if you could, is that the multiple relationship, the 3.05? Is that the?
Correct.
And then double D, which is the ethical standards adopted by the board. And I would suggest 3.05 multiple relationships. So I would actually, I can make that motion. I'll make that a motion.
Second.
Thank you.
So we have a motion and a second. Ms. Galvin, was that okay for a motion?
It was. Would you like to include as part of that motion a directive to staff to subpoena Dr. Knuckles to appear at the full board meeting and to submit a more full response with respect to some of the issues that you raised regarding records, telephone calls, the number, the length, the text messages, et cetera?
I would like to include that in the motion. Dr. Stewart, do you accept that as an amendment to the motion?
I accept that as my second, the amendment.
Perfect. All right. So we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you very much. We have one more item on the agenda, and that is item case number 3214, Dr. Kiever Konapsky. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, and I am the lead.
It's Lopinski.
I'm sorry.
It's Lopinski.
Well, Gosginski. I'm not going to get Dr. Luskinski.
Or Ms. Shreve, you could say the respondent.
The respondent. Thank you. So this is a complaint. We received the board received a complaint from JK on September 15th. So let me just back up. On August 25th, 2022, the board summarily suspended the respondent's psychologist's license and forwarded it to the matter of the formal hearing before OAH, which was to occur on September 21st. But prior to that September 21st day, we received a complaint from JK, who resides in the East Valley, that she participated in a therapy session with the respondent after his license had been suspended through Talkspace, which appears to be an app, a site, an online video therapy platform that connects users to licensed professionals in their state. JK had a virtual therapy session with the respondent on August 23rd, August 30th, and September 6th. Later on in the day on September 6th, she received notification from Talkspace that the respondent would no longer be available on Talkspace platform and received instructions to be matched with another provider. There was no reason given for this. On September 26th, the respondent notified us by email that once, and this is the respondent stated that, once I found out my license was suspended, I stopped work as a psychologist in Arizona. As instructed to do so by the Board of Psychology, Talkspace pulled all the Arizona members and then rematched them with others. As far as scheduling, I was booked out several months in advance, and that would have been done by the number themselves. I did not provide services to any Arizona Talkspace members once informed by the board of me, my license being suspended. And then the respondent's license was ultimately revoked by the board on December 27th, 2022. That's my summary. Is the complainant JK?
And neither party is here, Ms. Shreve.
Okay. So I guess what I need to ask, Ms. Galvin, can we get some direction on how to handle this?
Yes, I think you have two options. You can refer this to the full board with the recommendation that they issue a cease and desist letter to him, or the timeline that you presented. This complaint was received just a few days before we went to formal hearing. The matter of the pending complaint, the allegation that he provided services while his license was summarily suspended, was brought up in the hearing where we were seeking revocation of his license for other unprofessional conduct. And the ALJ did mention this in her recommended decision as a factor in aggravation that he had engaged in practicing psychology when his license was suspended. And it is in that recommended decision that the board adopted when they revoked his license. So essentially, you have that conduct on record. So if you don't want to refer it to the full board for like a cease and desist, another option would be is just to close this matter without prejudice. So if he were to come back, you could, fire this up again and adjudicate it. But the fact that you're not closing it because, there are no violations, but you can close it without prejudice because it was, dealt with, at least addressed at some level by the ALJ and our previous hearing that we had in September of 2022.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. All right. We can go into deliberations regarding this case. So it appears we have a couple of different options. I am comfortable with closing the matter without prejudice. It was addressed by the ALJ. ALJ. Yeah. And then a recommendation did come back to the board, and then we approved that recommendation. Is there any comments, any thoughts?
I agree.
Dr. Medina?
As well, I agree.
Okay, so I'll make a motion that we close the matter without prejudice. And do I need to say anything more than that?
For the reason that the allegation was addressed in the board's final decision in December of 2022.
Okay, so without prejudice for exactly that reason. That's my motion. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Before we close the meeting, I'd like to thank staff for all your work, for getting us prepared. You do an incredible job. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Ms. Galvin, you are the best. We appreciate you, all your legal advice. Couldn't do it without you. And Dr. Medina, I hope this was not too painful and was a good opportunity for you. So we do appreciate you being part of this committee.
I'm sorry, my internet froze. Can you repeat everything?
I just thank the staff because they did a great job. And I did a big thank you to Ms. Galvin because she keeps us on the straight and narrow. And also wanted to thank you. I know this is your first meeting and we appreciate you being part of this. We need you. So really big thank you. So the last item on the agenda is to close the meeting. Is there a motion?
Move that we adjourn.
Adjourn?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Oh, good. Hearing none, we are adjourned. So until next
time. Thank you, everyone.